secrecy. When we talk about secrecy, we often think about personal secrets, right? We often talk about the secrets we don't want our neighbors knowing. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for listening. I am 970 The Answer. I'm Frank Moreno. But there's so little attention paid until recently about government secrets. What secrets should government be seeking? What secrets should governments be revealing? How should they go about getting those secrets and revealing those secrets if they need to be revealed? These are issues that have fascinated me for a couple of years now, and my eyes were really opened to this by a book written by our next guest. But in the last couple of weeks, listening to the war that is going on between the intelligence community and the president-elect, I am obsessed with this story now. What role should our intelligence agencies be playing? How should they be classifying information? Those are a few of the issues that I want to delve into with our next guest. And let me tell you about our next guest. He is a true legend when it comes to many different things. First of all, his name itself is legendary, as anybody that's ever purchased a toy in New York City can tell you. But he wrote a book called Democracy in the Dark, The Seduction of Government Secrecy. And I guess a year and a half or two ago, whenever this book came out, I lost it on the bus when I was about four-fifths of the way done with it. Left it on the express bus, tried in earnest to get the MTA to return it, could not do it, and then I ran to the library to take it out of the library. Library branch didn't have it, so I had to request it at one specific branch. I ran down there like, again, a kid, you know, trying to get out of school at 3:01 when the bell is ringing. As soon as they told me this book was available, and I devoured it. It is an incredible, incredible read. I'll give you the title again, Democracy in the Dark, The Seduction of Government Secrecy. Its author is sitting aside from me in the studio now, Frederick A.O. Schwarz Jr., the senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice. Fritz Schwarz, thanks so much for coming in this morning.
Well, I'm really happy to be here.
The happiness is all mine. I have so many questions for you with respect to the intelligence community and secrecy in general. So folks know your background and how you came to approach this subject. Many folks, I'm sure, know your record here in New York City, chair of the Charter Revision Commission and a number of other good government commissions. But 40 years ago, I guess more than 40 years ago now, you were the chief counsel to the Church Committee, right?
Yes, I was.
What was the Church Committee, and how does that play into the conversations we're having now?
Well, the Church Committee has nothing to do with churches. It was named for Frank Church, who was the chair of a nonpartisan select committee, and nonpartisan because it worked that way. We had six Democrats and five Republicans. And our assignment from the Senate was to investigate the intelligence community, which had never been done. Congress before had, in effect, washed their hands of information. They often said, we'd rather not know information. So we did the most extensive investigation of an intelligence community in the United States ever and in the world ever. And, of course, the subject of secrets and secrecy was important because we had to, with the Ford administration and the FBI and the CIA and the NSA, we had to get the crucial documents, and that was a big fight. And one of my, I think, most important contributions as chief counsel was to say, when you have an investigation like this, you have to get the actual facts, because if you don't get them, the public will see no reason to reform. So we got the actual facts eventually, and we distinguished, of course, between legitimate secrets and illegitimate secrets. And that's important because there are things that are legitimately secret. And the best examples of those are anything that would lead to the name of a spy or an agent, and things that would reveal exactly how we do electronic surveillance, as two examples of legitimate secrets. But
so there should be some things, obviously, yes, for the sake of national security and for the sake of security of individuals, that should be kept secret. Everybody agrees on that, right?
Yes.
But now we have gotten to a point in our country where, based on reading your book, I got a worldwide education, and based on even 40 years ago, but still to the present day, where it seems like way too much is classified. Is that fair?
That is fair. Way too much is classified, and equally important, way too much is kept classified for an unduly long period of time. For example, the Bay of Pigs, which happened in 1961, the CIA is still keeping some of those documents secret.
Before we get to what's happening now, which I'm very eager to get your take on, there was a lot made during the last presidential campaign about Hillary Clinton's use of email. It now appears, at least according to the FBI director, James Comey, that whether intentionally or unintentionally, there was classified information either sent or received on an unsecured email server. Give me your view, if you would, on that whole brouhaha, whether Hillary was culpable in some wrongdoing or whether you're closer to her explanation that really she didn't do anything wrong.
I come out that she did not commit a crime, and the discussion about those few documents that were marked as classified, although without the header on the top of the page that you use, that was a misplaced inquiry. The legitimate inquiry, I think, was whether she did this in order to have more personal control over responses to FOIA, Freedom of Information Act requests. And I think that was one of the reasons, and that was not a good reason. So I say no crime and never really any serious suggestion that there was, yet a mistake that was wrong, because I believe the motivation was included limiting the public ability to use FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act.
So you think this was not her initial explanation, which is she wanted the convenience of one device rather than two. This was an attempt probably to keep the public from gaining access to information.
I think to keep personal control over whether the public was going to get information.
Now, let's move a little more recently. Over the last couple of weeks, there's been all sorts of news, especially since 2 weeks ago when the Director of National Intelligence testified before Congress that it seems as if the Russians clearly attempted to hack the DNC email server and exercise a fair amount of influence on the election. Give me a reaction to that aspect of this whole situation.
I think, assuming that's true, that is very troubling, and we as a country should be very concerned. And I think it's encouraging to see Republicans like John McCain and Lindsey Graham saying there has to be a select committee investigation. And I want to emphasize that word select committee. That's what the Church Committee was. It was not an existing committee. And it's healthy for really important things to have a select committee. You get the opportunity to select people who don't have a bias on the subject. In our case, it was very helpful that the people selected had not been part of the inadequate oversight of the FBI.
Certainly,
and the
right.
CIA.
You don't want the same people that have screwed things up now in a position to exercise domain over those same agencies they've messed up.
And I think the other advantage, again, is proven by what happened with the Church Committee, is the likelihood of getting nonpartisan consensus is a little greater, I think, when it's a special committee. And our most important finding of the Church Committee, I mean, we talked about the FBI's effort to get Martin Luther King to commit suicide, which we established.
That's a fact.
That's a fact. The CIA's hiring of the mafia, actually entering into a deal with the mafia to hire them to kill Fidel Castro.
That's a fact as well. This is not a wild conspiracy theory or anything like that.
It's a fact. And the third one that I'll mention is we discovered that the NSA had been collecting every single telegram that left the United States. Great abuse of their power. Our most important finding, though, was a nonpartisan finding that each president from Franklin Roosevelt through Richard Nixon, we were operating. We started under President Ford. Nixon had left. But each president, from Franklin Roosevelt to Richard Nixon, six of them happened to be four Democrats and two Republicans, but each of them had abused their secret powers. And that nonpartisan conclusion—
Every single one.
Yeah, every single one, some more, some less. Mm-hmm. I mean, it tended to get a little worse with Johnson, Nixon, than it had been with Roosevelt and Truman and Eisenhower. And Kennedy was kind of in between. But every single president had abused their secret power. That helped us have internal cohesion because, you know, six Democrats, five Republicans, internal cohesion and external credibility. And that you also want to be looking for a special committee, I think, having a mind and eye toward, are these people the kind of people who will be nonpartisan and therefore more credible?
So very interesting revelations there about the role of the FBI, the CIA, and the NSA in all three. I'll characterize them as misdeeds that you just described. After the Russian hacking story becomes public, and if people are just tuning in, we're talking with Fritz Schwarz, who has such a lengthy resume, I could not even begin to list it on a 4.5-hour program. He's the senior counsel these days at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. They do a lot of great work in terms of government reform and a lot of reform issues in general. Also the author of a terrific book. It's a couple of years old now, still worth reading, Democracy in the Dark. After that whole situation, Donald Trump goes on a Twitter tirade mocking the intelligence agencies. He puts the word intelligence in quotation marks, mocks the fact that they got it wrong when it comes to weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, is all over the intelligence agencies. And then Senator Chuck Schumer, the leader, not only New York senior senator, but the leader of the Senate Democrats, goes on the Rachel Maddow show on MSNBC and says the following.
You take on the intelligence community, they have six ways from Sunday at getting back at you. So even for a practical, supposedly hard-nosed businessman, he's being really dumb to do this.
What do you think the intelligence community would do if they were
I don't know.
So Chuck Schumer says, hey, this is a senior guy in government. This is a guy that's worked in government at the federal level for decades. Chuck Schumer says, I'd be real careful messing with the intelligence agencies. Tell me in your view and in your study and your research, not only for this book, but with the Church Committee, is Chuck Schumer right? Should people, even presidents, have to worry about these intelligence agencies?
Well, I don't think that's the best argument for the one that Senator Schumer made. That they have a lot of power. The best argument is that they ought to be investigated to see whether they've done something wrong or not. With respect to Trump's comments, I thought they were conclusory and also unfair in that the intelligence community, for all their mistakes, which they've made some of, certainly some important ones, they've got other things in the past wrong too or failed to know about, but they get a lot right, and in general they're seeking to do the best job to protect America, and they should be criticized if they deserve criticism. They should be investigated from time to time. They certainly should be overseen by the Congress, but they're not deserving of the kind of blunderbuss 140-letter attacks that the president-elect has made.
It seems to me, in researching this a little bit and, you know, hearing from some folks that are no longer in the mainstream of the leadership of the intelligence community. And I spoke in the last week at this time with Bill Binney, who was an NSA whistleblower prior to Edward Snowden. In fact, I asked him about Chuck Schumer's remark. This is a bit of what he said.
Yeah, it's like they're J. Edgar Hoover on super steroids. You know, that was the whole point of J. Edgar Hoover. And he's actually very close to the truth because some of the major people who are being monitored by these agencies are, in fact, the members of the Congress of the United States, members of the Supreme Court, other federal judges, you know, and Joint Chiefs of Staff members and so on. Anybody who has power over them, they monitor. And so he's absolutely right. You know, They if they don't have something on, they'll find something. They'll create something. You can manufacture it, you know?
So now he was with the NSA for 30 years. And it seems to me, and this is what's concerning to me as an American, just a private citizen, is that these intelligence agencies and their leadership don't necessarily seem to be accountable to the elected branches of government. They seem to sort of have their own agenda, irrespective of who's elected. Is that accurate?
I think it's exaggerated. The intelligence agencies have an agenda to protect themselves as well as to do their job, which is to keep the government informed. But I thought those remarks were unbalanced and over the top. That does not mean that the intelligence agencies shouldn't be investigated from time to time in a major way, shouldn't be overseen all the time by the Congress. But I think you shouldn't paint with that broad a brush. And the reason, getting back to the Church Committee...
Well, that's no fun. Nuance is no fun.
Come on. Yeah, it's true. It's true. But the House Committee failed to be nuanced, and we were nuanced. We were a great success, and they didn't succeed because they failed to have nuance, and they also didn't recognize that there are some legitimate secrets.
One of your prior books that I hate to admit that I haven't read, but I'm looking forward to reading it, is Unchecked and Unbalanced, which deals with the role of executive power. I'm wondering if you can describe for our audience how the powers of the presidency and the powers of the executive branch have grown over the years and why that may be problematic.
Well, they have grown over the years without any question. The question is and I think nobody's going to turn back that clock. We have a when George Washington took office, he employed more people on his plantation than the whole federal government employed.
Wow.
It's a big deal different now. The economy requires a more active president. The national security requires a more active presidency. So we have, and we're not going to lose a very active presidency. But it shouldn't act without recognizing and respecting the restraints. And that book, Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror, is more about the Bush-Cheney presidency than anything else. And it makes the argument that the roads they went down on torture, for example, were inconsistent with the restraints and checks, and that they tried to avoid being restrained and checked, including by doing things that were overly secret, completely secret. There's a big difference. For example, I use some examples in the last chapter of the book, which you hadn't read before you lost it, but you now have read Unchecked and Unbalanced, about the difference between legitimate secrecy for specific acts but not legitimate secrecy for a program. And the one example I gave of that was the Nixon-Kissinger policy and practice of bombing Cambodia, which was a neutral nation. We were at war in Vietnam, but Cambodia was a neutral nation, and the Congress hadn't said anything about legitimizing bombing Cambodia. It's hard to say that, well, if the question was, should you reveal that a specific plane is going to bomb Phnom Penh, which is the capital of Cambodia, leaving at 4 o'clock in the morning from some such place? No, you shouldn't expose that. But you should expose the fact that there's a program of bombing Cambodia. And the same thing applies when you come down to today.
Well, so in your book, and I really think this is the cornerstone of why I was so interested in your book, and it's something that I confess that I didn't have a full comprehension of prior to reading it, is one of the themes you talk about is that too much secrecy, too much government secrecy from the public leads to poor public policy decisions, sometimes disastrously poor public mm-hmm. policy decisions. One of the items that you do cite is the role of secrecy in the run-up to the Hiroshima and Nagasaki nuclear bombing. Give our audience an idea of why secrecy in that respect was problematic.
Yeah, actually, I think that's one of the more interesting parts in the whole book. I start out by saying whether or not the atomic bomb should have been used, which is
right,
beyond...
Right, varying people can have varying
Yeah, it's beyond
opinions.
The scope of the book I wrote. But nobody would say that we should have revealed where and when we were going to drop the bomb. So it was a legitimate secret. But the problem was the decision to bomb Japan and to bomb a big city was made on May 30th of 1945. The bomb on Hiroshima and the one on Nagasaki were not until early August, so several months later. In the intervening time, there were some important changes, like, one, the bomb was much more powerful than what the decision makers had thought it was going to be, and two, more bombs were available. But the point I made about secrecy is the decision makers stopped thinking and stopped listening to anybody else because nobody else had anything to say since they didn't even know anything about the possibility of a bomb. So that if you have a legitimately secret program, including particularly a huge one with moral and warlike implications like the atomic bomb, you shouldn't reveal that to the world, but you ought to discipline yourself to keep on thinking. So you see, it's in contrast to if something is known, then it's going to happen. You get lots of public comment, and mm-hmm. therefore there are lots of outsiders reminding you to think of
right.
A, B, and
sure.
C. But when it's secret, it's only you who can keep on thinking, and therefore you ought to think even harder.
On the national security front, and I could talk about this with you all day, and unfortunately we're running out of time, but I am going to ask you to explain this instance as well. You talk about how the secrecy dealing with the resolution to the Cuban Missile Crisis led to a poor public policy result.
Yeah.
Tell me what happened there.
Well, that's interesting. At the very end of the missile crisis, Robert Kennedy and John Kennedy, with the knowledge of about five other people, go to the Russian ambassador in Washington and say, look, if you pull your nuclear missiles out of Cuba, a few months later, we'll pull ours out of Turkey. And it was kind of an easy thing to offer to do because we knew we had the submarine missiles, which were probably going to be even better than having the missiles in Turkey. But that was a deal we made. However, only those five people plus John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy knew we'd made the deal. And they badly wanted to keep it secret and agreed to do so, and it was kept secret for about 30 years when it finally comes out. I think Ted Sorensen or who...
And so why is that a problem for the public?
Because the public and, more importantly, Lyndon Johnson, who was on the big committee thinking about what to do, but he was one of the ones not told about what was done. Lyndon Johnson had the belief that Kennedy won the missile crisis and got enormous acclaim because he was tough, 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 and only tough. When the truth was, he was tough,
but then he
made a deal. And it's my thesis and also some pretty expert people in the foreign policy establishment that one of the reasons Johnson didn't make a deal in Vietnam is because he felt he couldn't be less tough than his predecessor.
Fascinating. Completely different subject. I'll end with this. A lot of folks recognized that their city council members work hard, but do they really work hard enough to merit a $140,000 salary? You were the chairman of a commission evaluating whether or not city council members should get a raise. You said they should get a raise, but they should have to give up their outside income. They're now earning $140,000 a year. They are the best paid legislators, municipal legislators in the whole country. Tell me about your conclusions in that commission that you chaired and the fact and your reaction to that. New Yorkers city councils are the best paid in the whole country.
I think L.A. may be higher, but they're well paid for a government official. First, it is a hard job. You do draw some more people if they're paid more. Second, they were giving up two benefits. One, the right to like practice law at the same time as they're sitting in the city council. And two, there was a practice called Lulu's where you got extra pay if you chaired a commission. And it ended up that about 44 out of 51 got this extra pay. And so it was just a device for extra pay, but it wasn't included as part of your salary. And we thought it should be A, eliminated, but B, then the average Lulu should be spread among the council members. And the other thing I'll say about our decision, commissions earlier than ours, which operated in 2015, had pretty much always given a raise based on the consumer price index. We thought that would have led to too large a number, and we picked the sort of statistical thing to use as a check, the average household income, and we thought that was something council members could do something about, whereas they can't do anything about inflation.
Sure.
So those were the reasons.
So there you have it. Well, if I hope we could talk again, and it's been enlightening. And whether it's on good government issues, municipal-wise or state-wise, or on helping us understand this incredible intelligence bureaucracy that so often seems Byzantine in its complexity, you're able to explain it in such clear terms, both verbally and on the printed page. I hope we could talk again soon.
Okay, I enjoyed it.
If you want to comment, by the way, let me recommend the book again, Democracy in the Dark, The Seduction of Government Secrecy. If you want to comment on any portion of my conversation with Fritz Schwarz, you're welcome to give me a call at 877-970-2999. That's 877-970-2999. This is Frank Moreno on AM 970, The Answer.
More wit and wisdom in just a moment with Morano on AM 970, The Answer. News, opinion, passion. This is AM 970, The Answer.
31 and skies are mainly clear around the tri-state area on the way to about 45 for this afternoon. Good morning. What's going on? We have the answer. More of Morano in the Morning coming up following the news. A week of protest ahead of Donald Trump's inauguration as president getting underway, and things kicked off Saturday with Reverend Al Sharpton leading a civil rights march and rally along the National Mall in Washington.